Ah, that ended suddenly, didn't it? Just like the show starts quite quickly. Hello, it is Tuesday, it's not. Look at that. It's Thursday, again, the 14th of March, 2024. This is Paul English Live. Welcome to the show. On tonight's show, we're going to be joined by Thomas Anderson, I hope, and therein lies a tale. We're here with you for the next couple of hours, although, of course, who we turns out to be is looking quite interesting right now. I'd like to tell you that it's been a fun week in Blighty, but I can't tell you that. It hasn't. Welcome back to Paul English Live. We're here every Thursday. I have to put an error in at the beginning. It's my trademark stamp. We're here every Thursday at 8 p.m. UK time and usually 3 p.m. US Eastern time. But old dung for brains here today got it wrong on the little poster that I sent out, and I still left it showing 3 p.m. So if you've been sat out there going, "Ooh, he's not turning up, it's all gone a little bit pear-shaped." Well, it goes pear-shaped anyway, really, but apologies for that. We'll be US time-wise for the next 3 weeks, including this week, so that's what, the 14th, the 21st, and the 28th of March, the Ides of March, the Winds of March. We're going to be starting at 4 p.m. US Central Time. And this is, of course, due to the wonderful cockamamie relationship that we all have with the clocks. As I've mentioned here before, I think it's a bit bonkers that we actually even adjust them in the first place. But if we're going to do that, you would think it might be prudent, sensible, wise, yes, qualities that are in very, very short supply these days, for us to all do it at the same time in the Northern Hemisphere. But no, no. So I kind of envy the Americans a little bit, because you get a whole month extra of summertime, I think. You start your clocks, or you put them forward 3 weeks before we do. It's not always 3 weeks, sometimes it's two, but it's 3 weeks this year. It's a long stretch through, and then you run on for an extra week afterwards. So this always makes it fun. And some of the schedules that I'm involved with, of course, are reading all wrong, which makes it even more interesting. And of course, I could do a fantastic show about timekeeping. In fact, I mentioned the other week about the Watchmaker's Apprentice. I don't know if any of you actually followed it up. I put a link in, I think, on that show. It's the one with the clock on, a couple of weeks ago, and gosh, choking as well. I'd recommend it very much if you're into seeing somebody make a watch. You might not think you're into that sort of thing, but I suspect that if you start watching it, you will be. It's a wonderful film about making watches from scratch. So there we go. Anyway, welcome to the show. My guest tonight is Thomas Anderson, or it will be if Thomas exists, or he can turn up. So I've got one of those moments. I haven't had one of those moments yet. There's always something to talk about. We can talk about why Thomas, of course, he's letting the side down with the German punctuality side of things. I did speak to him the other day, had a wonderful chat with him, and we've put links through to his books on the Rumble chat and to some of his articles recently. And I suspect he will turn up at some point, but if he doesn't, it's just me stroking my beard. Yes, I do have one now because I haven't got shaved for a few weeks, and possibly a few of you joining in and pitching in. So until Thomas arrives, I wanted to I've actually got a little clip lined up. I was hoping to play this a little bit later in the show, but we'll start it now, shall we? I think we probably better. This was something. Oh, I know. There's some other things. So let me just do another shout out here as well. I'm a bit dopey on all this kind of stuff. Here we are. We're on WBN 324. The links to the streams can be found on paulenglishlive.com. There's all the little links there, which you will find. We're also being carried on Rumble, which is the main place for the chat. So if you want to actually immerse yourself in with lots of chatters, and it's been getting livelier and livelier each week. Along with little hidden voices like that that pop up into the mix from time to time, then head on over to Rumble. Hello, Paul. Hi, how are you?
No audio on Rumble. That's really what they're saying in the chat.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. That's hilarious. Okay, hang on. Let me have a look. wow. Really?
That's quite hilarious.
No, good grief. No audio at all.
Yep, it's there now.
Is it really? Hey, thanks for the shout-out. That's fantastic. Thanks, technical support man, Paul. Great name, of course. Fantastic. Yeah, I didn't actually do anything wrong with that this week, but I tell you what, it's been a day of technical trousers being on fire in other departments. I've had all sorts of nonsense going on, so which I'm not going to bore you with. Well, I might do later on. I know everybody loves it. Let's talk about technical troubles. We're going out on Rumble. We are going out on Rumble, and apparently the sound is coming through. Loud and clear on Rumble here, says Eric. Thanks, Eric, for the shout-out. That's great. Much appreciated. Okay. Yep, so there seems to be some intermittent problems with sound on Rumble. We're also going out on DLive. You could always try that. I only added that the other week because it was suggested to me, even though I've had an account there for years, normally used it as a little test account. So we're also running out on DLive. You'll find a link to that as well on the website. So yeah, we're on WBN 324, and just by way of personal little anecdote, the last few days have been quite interesting. A lot of new people have started following me on Rumble, and that's courtesy of, I'm reasonably sure, in fact I know, I was kindly invited on to the WBN 324 flagship show. I think we can call it that. In fact, I know we can call it that because it is that. Sunday Long Live Radio with the host Rhea Bow. Rhea kindly contacted me a few weeks ago and said, would you like to come in and talk during the fourth hour? Which I did, and that was fun. I talked a lot. I tend to do that, particularly in a first-time environment. But Rhea was fantastic, and quite a bit of positive feedback, I think, from some of the people listening in there. Shout-out to Joss as well for your kind comment elsewhere on Rumble, I think it is. So that was good. So that all turned out pretty well. And if I didn't upset too many people, I may be back there once a month, I think, something like that. Anyway, it's not a fixed gig at the moment, but I really enjoyed my stay there this Sunday just gone. And thanks, everybody, for sending the positive comments through as they came in. That show runs on WBN 324 every Sunday, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern, usually. But yet again, with the cockamamie, clockamamie stuff that's going on, it's currently, for the next few weeks, 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. That's U.S. Eastern time. That's U.S. Eastern. So very long show, of course, hence the title, 4 hours. But it does tend to sort of zoom by, so it's become part of my regular listening week as that show. A lot of fun, a lot of good comments, a lot of sharp comments as well from time to time. So it's a really good mix of things over there. I would recommend it. I am recommending it. So there we go. Now that we've cleared our technical trouser department and got everything sorted out, as I said, I've got a little clip for you. And I was actually hoping at some point to get this clip into my little spot with Rhea at the weekend, but there was so much to talk about it being the first time. It didn't really come up. Now, you may recall a woman called Liz Truss. Probably you don't recall her too much because she was a parachute prime minister, which is what I call them. Most of them, who was the last one to actually be voted in? Was it Boris or Doris or whoever it was? But they've all been basically replacing one another as the Conservative Party. Yes, what do they conserve? Not much. As the Conservative Party have been trundling through the months and just dropping them in. So we had Liz Truss, and she, I guess, was the most stark example of a brief prime minister. As I said, she was there for, I think, about 49 days, or maybe 47. And she's slightly... I don't know what to say. You've probably got your own view about it. But, you know, obviously, at the time, nobody really thought too much of it. She didn't last very long, although news has started coming out that she was trying to ruffle feathers and do things. Anyway, I stumble across this very brief clip, but it's notable for all sorts of reasons. Let me just... where is it now? Here it is. So she was on with Steve Bannon. You may be familiar with Steve Bannon. Not a running mate, was he a PR guy for Trump in the last election? He's got his own radio show now, War Room, I think it is, a couple of hours every day of the week. I don't know what network it's on, but if you're into that sort of thing, you've probably caught it. But this is a one-minute clip. She was on a little sort of podium addressing people. Listen to this.
What I found out when I got into number 10 is I thought that if I got to the top of the tree... I would be able to implement those conservative policies.
So you think once you're prime minister, as a little girl thinking, if I get prime minister, I'll be like Churchill, I'll change the country.
Exactly.
That's not how it works.
Exactly. And what I discovered was that I was not holding the levers. The levers were held by the Bank of England, by the Office of Budget Responsibility. They weren't held by the prime minister or the chancellor. And I think that's a massive...
Hold on, that's a massive problem. Hang on. You're saying the central bank, the Bank of England, is one of the things that controls. Are you a conspiracy theory person? Worm. You're MAGA.
What I'm saying, Steve, is that if the Bank of England governor can't be sacked and the prime minister can be sacked, then the Bank of England governor is going to have more power than the prime minister. And that is a problem in a democracy. Because the fact is the left have succeeded in infiltrating our campuses.
The left have succeeded in infiltrating the campuses. That's actually not the key point. That now I could be mistaken here, but I'm not aware of any prime minister. Okay, ex prime minister. So recently, when was she prime minister? A couple of years ago? A year ago? I don't know. During the COVID malarkey, actually spilling the beans. She spilt the beans there, and of course, there's been no follow up on this. As many of you know, my main sort of foundational point with all of the troubles that we face is the bank, for the simple reason that we have to, if we want to sort everything else out, sort out the bank. We've got to sort out the bank. And in fact, it's just reminded me of a little book I've got somewhere in the other rag over at some point during this show, I suspect. Answers on a postcard, please. When was the last time you heard somebody who had recently been prime minister actually point their finger at last in the right direction of the spigot, the fount point of all of the problems that we face? Now, of course, we have all the dramas to talk about. We have Steve Bannon, of course, is part of the drama monger news cycle, and it's very entertaining, and you can get sucked into that and think you might be able to affect global affairs by participating in it. I'm not one of those people. I don't think you can. But on our own, in our own back garden, as it were, up the road for me, maybe down the road for you, we have the City of London, in which sits, he said in a Dickensian way, like the Lord Mayor of London, the High Court of Chancery. We have the head of the Bank of England. One of the things that Rhea pointed out when we were talking about banking on Sunday, and it's worth repeating, is that you're not allowed, it's against the law, to find out who the shareholders are of the bank. This is a very quick sentence to say, but the implications of it are long-standing, considerable, and extremely damaging. You may have heard me say in the past, when I was having my Fandango, my wonderful interaction with the Bank of England about 24, 25 years ago now. Afterwards, after the fallout of that, when I was very cross about what had happened, I made two or three phone calls, I think three was enough for me, to the bank to try and get a list of their shareholders. I wasn't expecting to get a result. I just wanted to see how I was handled. And so I called them and said, hello, you know, I'm Billy Nomates here out in the hinterlands of England. Could you tell me how I can get a list of the shareholders of the bank? Oh, we don't give out that information, sir. I said, no. I said, but you do have shareholders. Oh, we don't give out that information either. I said, well, you already have, haven't you, really? And so here we have this private institution that Liz Truss, the Prime Minister, bumped right into. And her point is extremely valid. If we believe, and it does require an awful lot of belief, if we believe that we live in a democratic society with freedom of speech, cough, cough, and we, supposedly, the electorate, are electing a political party with a leader that then becomes the Prime Minister to supposedly manage the interests of our nation, yet the person that we have elected has no power, control, or influence over the bank, what is the point of having one? In technical and pragmatic terms, there is no point, in my view. You might disagree. I mean, there is a point in terms of them providing the ongoing theatre of politics and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of their actual ability to change things, not very good. And she also, in saying these things, she actually does form a pattern of other individuals, but not prime ministers that I'm aware of. I think Disraeli, although I won't count him either for all sorts of other reasons, said something similar. He said something along the lines of, you know, people would not know who, it's people behind the scenes that actually control things. That was in the 1800s. And we also had Sir Josiah Stamp. He was at one point, the head of the Bank of England, I think in the late 20s, early 30s, this is in the 1900s, when they retire and they're out of the loop and they're not on the gravy train anymore, sometimes they have a sort of pang of conscience and they start to sort of spill their guts. And if you look up Josiah Stamp, Sir Josiah Stamp, you will find some pretty blinding quotes from him, where he's basically saying that if you allow bankers, which we do, I'm afraid, to continue to create the money that we use out of thin air, and you take it all away from them, it's something like this, he said, with a flick of a pen, they'll buy it all back. So, in terms of what's coming up for elections this year in America, is anybody talking about the Fed and how they're going to hand it over to the American people? No. Have they ever talked about that? No. Have any attempts that have been made to do that resulted in a success? Absolutely not. And although it's part of the reason, I would suggest, why he met an untimely and violent end, JFK was or is rumoured to have been part of a process that was to make the Treasury of the United States the fount, the spigot of issuing the currency based on silver, and not the Federal Reserve. So these so-called central banks are in fact private businesses owned by private individuals, the shareholders of which we cannot inquire into, we are not allowed to know, and yet we have prime ministers and politicians running around on the stage saying, we're going to sort out the economy. Yeah, usual sort of nonsense, I think, recently with a budget, haven't we? Or something. I don't pay any attention to this stuff because I actually think we'd be just as well served listening to the news from 35, 40 years ago. What's the point? It just run it round on a big loop. It doesn't really matter who's saying it. None of it comes to anything because, as Liz Truss points out, you go to the bank and if they say no, they go, oh, all right, and they walk off. Where's the power? It's with the bank. I can't really get off this topic, actually, because I do, I mean, I will, don't worry, we're not going to just talk about banking forever. It's a very good cure for insomnia, talking about central banking. It's pretty good. I mean, stay awake out there, please, please, if you can. It's a tricky one to keep ploughing on and on about, because we meet this kind of, this terrible wall of indifference from the bankers and also a great power base that they have. Now, if you want to know what the sort of power, how it works in very subtle but entirely thorough ways. We know, for example, that they can control trade. There was a big there was a big movement in the 90s. There was a guy called Stephen somebody or other. I can't remember his surname. Probably a professor. He wrote a book about interdependence. And I'm not into interdependence. I think it's just part of putting yourself in a compromised position. And bankers rely on it. A whole chain of events and effects come to bear on this, on their management of the economy. So if you want to move goods from certain countries to other countries and they don't like that, they have the ability to stop it happening. I'm just reading a couple of comments. A comment here from Eric. He said, in the 1930s, the City of London paid off Churchill's debts to the sum of £19,500, which would have been quite a bit of money then. It's actually be quite a bit of money now, wouldn't it? We could all do with a spare £19,500. Churchill simultaneously got into power in 1940. Joined the dots. Indeed, joined the dots. Dot joiners. There we are. That was a quick shout out and a little subtle reference to a group called the Dot Joiners that I know about. But that's kind of what we're up against. Now, I don't know if I've here on this show mentioned the people that fought back. The people that fought back is a salutary lesson for us, because whenever it's done on a national basis, it has always ended up in bloodshed or ruin for the individuals of those nations that have been seeking to get it across. So we have a very, very difficult task in front of us. First of all, it's a pretty long-winded at times and tedious sort of body of information that you have to acquire. Although I personally found it thrilling and still do, because it links into every other sort of major historical event that we've been subject to, certainly since the advent of the Bank of England and really before that. So for those of you who are keen on dates, that was 1694 the Bank of England came about. And that really was the beginning of the end of the autonomy of the British people in terms of having a say in the outcome of your life. You will have noted that since that date, 1694, I think there's only been 3 or 4 years in which this country, this nation, has not had troops or navies or military men going around in the world imposing force on others. And in nearly all cases, it's to extend the economic hegemony of the bank. So there wasn't a British Empire. There wasn't one. There was an empire of the City of London, and that empire still exists. And of course, along with their banking control has come their control of the courts. And we've seen that even recently with the case of Sam Melia, because there are influences at play there to adjust, reshape the condition of our nation. We're not alone in this, of course. It's going on all over Europe and in North America as well. And they're very brazen about it now. There's a kind of vacuous stupidity about the political response to all of these things, because I don't see a political response. Do you? Is there one? So it's a pity that Liz Truss couldn't have said that when she was in power, but you've got to give her a due. She only had 47 or 49 days, whatever it was. And I suspect that because she was prying around into those things, that probably would have been a major causative reason for why she only lasted a very brief time. The little comment that she made at the end there, of course, about the left infiltrating everything. Well, of course, absolutely. This has been the long march through the institutions we've had over here. What have we got? We've got lots of little societies all intertwined, interdependent, you could say, pounding away at this stuff. You've got the Fabian Society using a very long, slow approach, which is devastatingly effective, unfortunately, because these institutions become wrapped up, bound in to a sort of worldview. And then if you ever were to have the opportunity to speak to any of the individuals in these institutions, you're not really going to get anywhere. Why is it not a major concern to them? The bank. And if you want to know what the solutions are, you can look at National Socialist Germany in the from 1933 to 1939. It's not simply a straightforward job of them replacing bankers' money. There's lots of other influences, and there were major investors in that country, such as the Ford Motor Company, and a lot of Wall Street was involved, as covered by Anthony Sutton. Those books are very useful. I don't agree with Sutton on all points, but his research is fantastic in terms of getting a lot of the detailed stuff down. So you begin to see that wherever money is, there's a similar sort of pattern repeated over and over. And sadly, sad to report, the end result is usually that the nation that's instigating these sorts of just economic steps on behalf of the people that elected it, those nations tend to get bombed to smithereens, literally. Somebody sent, excuse me, somebody sent me the other day a clip of Louis Farrakhan. You might be familiar with him. He's an outspoken communicator for, is it the Brotherhood of Islam? I've probably got the name wrong, but he's part of that movement in the States. Much of what he says is absolutely spot on. And he was giving a little report. I'm going to just have a little, you know, and the announcer says, I've got to have a glass of water. Here we go. It was water, by the way. Shot through with a little bit of apple juice. Nothing naughty. He was talking about Gaddafi and Libya. And I think that's the most recent example I can think of where the leader of a nation put the economy at the service of the people. And it was a major, major thing. By way of reminder, many of you might already be familiar with this, I don't know. If you got married in Libya, they would set you off on your way to have a family, which is what it's all about, remember? It's very difficult with all this drama going on, but that's really what it's about. No families, no children, no small people running around, no future. It's really that simple. And he would make this money available to couples so that they could raise families in economically supportive conditions. They were also paying for university educations for people that came forward. And this was because they had great revenues from a certain type of oil that they have there. I think it's light oil, which was a type of refined oil that became almost like a sort of gold standard of oil. It was the oil against which much of the other oil prices were measured, and they were producing this. So it had a lot of surplus revenues. And he built also what is known as Gaddafi's Folly, which turned out to be not a folly at all. That's what it was called during the construction project. This is this immense, you've probably seen pictures of it, this immense pipeline, this water pipeline that he put in place to effectively irrigate parts of Libya and make them fertile. And it worked. So I don't know how long it was. It's about 1400 miles, this thing. I mean, it's a colossal engineering project, but they had the money and the resources and the backing to do it. And the country was thriving. Of course, he's portrayed in the West, aren't they all, as this evil dictator. And I'm sure he must have had to be a strong man. Let's put it that way. Most of us, of course, are never going to experience what it's like to be in a position of power like that. Unfortunately, I can hear many of you mutter yes. It's probably not going to happen in these lifetimes that we've got, although you never know. Things can come out of nowhere. But by doing what he did, of course, he was portrayed in the way that he was portrayed, which was this evil person. So on many points, he was doing good things. He also, which I'm sure many of you will recall, said that if Libya went down, that Europe would be engulfed in a stream of migrants and other people piling through from that part of Africa, to overwhelm Europe. One could say then, if we sort of look at it logically, I want to draw out a few conclusions, that the taking out of Gaddafi was to do just that thing. Why wouldn't it be? Because the very people that are threatened, i.e. the central banking mob, that are threatened by a nation putting its economy at the service of its people, are also the ones that are threatened by a restoration of Western Christian civilized values. They don't want to see that back. Very difficult, you see, to have a one-world government if you've got a lot of people still running around on the good fumes of Christianity, which I think is probably a good description of it at the moment. Although maybe those fumes are building up to something a bit more substantial in a way. And when I use that phrase, I'm not talking about organized religion. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about law and the principles of it, including, and we touched on this as well, including economic law. the laws of economics as laid down in those old scriptural books, which are a darn sight better, that's an understatement, than what we're having to endure right now. If you've been exposed to the economic news, it's exactly the same as it was, as I said, 40 or 50 years ago. Worry, 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 inflation, deflation, this, that, and the other. Now we've got to worry about the banks owning global currencies, digital currencies, which is what they're after. They've always been after this kind of stuff. Bitcoin, however, may still prove to be a fly in their ointment. I don't quite know with that. I don't spend too much time looking at it, although any of you out there that are invested, is that the right word, in Bitcoin, or taking a punt, might be a better phrase on it. If you've had some that you bought a couple of years ago or a year back, you're probably laughing right now. Isn't the price something like $70,000 a Bitcoin? It's just peaked at its highest peak ever, something like that. So I had a little bit of the stuff around, but I just got a little bit tired with the whole thing. Of course, I wouldn't be tired for a few Bitcoins. So if you want to send me a few, you know, just anybody got a Bitcoin that they don't want, yes, a whole one, please, just contact me in some way or other, and I won't say no to it. So there we go. just to let you know, here we are, we're half an hour in. Looks like my guest, Thomas Anderson, so I won't refer to him too much more, but Thomas, it's a bit of a mystery to me, actually. I did speak to him the other day. It may be that he has got his times wrong like I did, but I did tell him 8 o'clock UK time, which was 9 o'clock. He's based in Central Europe, so I think it's Germany or Austria or somewhere like that. So I was expecting him to show up. So if he doesn't, we'll have to reschedule that one for a later date. what I'm going to do, the only thing I didn't do was prep any other stuff, you see, because I've known him for quite a few years and he's so reliable. He's so reliable. But I think this is in keeping with my week. This is good. I'm going to play you a song by Kevin Coyne here because I like this song and I'm just going to take a breather, and that's what we're going to do. Fire some texts in the Rumble thing. We'll start reading them out. Oh, and because the show's going this way, if you want to, if you say, I want to hear a song, stick it in the Rumble chat and we'll get on with it. Here we go. This is Sea of Love. You'll know the song, but by Kevin Coyne, sung in a particularly, I think, haunting way. Here we go. Thank you.
seeking uninterrupted access to WBN 324 talk radio despite incoming censorship hurdles? Well, it's a breeze. Just grab and download Opera Browser, then type in WBN324.zil. And stay tuned for unfiltered discussions around the clock. That's WBN324.zil.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on the World Broadcasting Network are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of its owners, partners, and other hosts or this network. Thank you for listening to WBN 324 Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome back. We're halfway through the first hour, just over the first hour. And if you're just joining us now, this is Paul English Live. We're here every Thursday. I say we. This is currently a Billy No Mates production, courtesy of yours truly. Just to let you know, the show is billed to have a guest called Thomas Anderson. He must be at home writing another book or something like that. So if he does show up, obviously we'll bring him in. But so far, and I was just doing a few little shout-outs to him there during the music, see if I could find him, but he's been lost in the wires of the internet. This is very much in keeping with my week, actually. I've had all sorts of lovely little things happening like that. Just looking at a few comments as well in the chat here. Eric says, I can have a few fock bobs, the currency of his country. Thanks very much, Eric. I don't know what I could buy with them, but I would keep them and preserve them, and they can go into my money collection of all those sorts of things. Somebody else was also talking about Bitcoin and the whole of the digital currency thing being a bit of a scam. I tend to that view, I have to tell you. It doesn't mean that people aren't going to speculate on it and make a short-term, fast, immense buck if you're in on the loop. I always felt that I'm the sort of person that never would be in on the loop. I had to sort of let go of all that kind of stuff. But if you've succeeded at it, well done. My sort of observation about it, you may recall, now this would be about, when, 2015, 16, I think something like that, a court case came up in New York, a district of New York. I can't remember the name of the judge, nice man, nice to dogs, all that kind of stuff. I just made all that up. I have no idea who he was. And it was to do with, at the time, the large exchange makers for digital currency. I can't remember the names of them now. They've probably disappeared. Maybe they've not. Maybe they've gone on to even bigger things. But they were turning over quite a lot. Anyway, the case had come up that they shouldn't be allowed to do this or something like that, you see, because obviously the reason why Bitcoin is communicated is that, and I did it earlier, people communicate it in terms of its pricing model, which is as dollars. I told you, I think, or I said that it's just hit a new high of $70,000. But conversely, we could say that the dollar has now hit a new low against Bitcoin, if you get my drift. Why do we quote everything in dollars? Because that's the currently, it's hanging on by its bare fingernails, as you can see, and that'll all be to plan as well. That's the exit currency. That's the world's default currency. It used to, of course, be the British pound, which was marvellous, of course, because it's a pound, you see, and it's just better because bankers in London say that it was. But it was decided to move the epicentre of world economic management to America over the course of World War II, which was part and parcel of one of the reasons for that conflict. There was a guy called the American representative, I think. There was a big meeting with John Maynard Keynes, who some of you may have had to endure in economics classes at school. I did. John Maynard Keynes and his theories about this, that and the other, supply and demand curves and all that kind of stuff. I didn't pay too much attention to economics. Although my economics teacher, Mr. Fils, that was his name, F-I-L-S, I suppose that's, is that French for son or something like that? Anyway, he's also a French teacher, so he did French and economics. Poor Mr. Fils, he was actually really rather fun, but I didn't pay attention to either of those lessons. First of all, I didn't want to speak French because my father instructed me that it was wrong to learn French because, you know, there'd be nothing but trouble for us and this, that and the other. And of course, being a northerner, I immediately, I warmed to that instantly. So I remember, I think on my French exam, I intentionally did as bad as I possibly could. I put something in, but I got 6%, and I was rather proud about that, although I was hoping to get down to about 2 or 3%. They said, you've failed. I said, good, I've not, I've succeeded. So, of course, it's a bit of a Philistine attitude, isn't it? And I have to say, my feelings toward the French have changed and evolved, as have I, as has my waistline. So some years later, I actually was in France, out in a rural district. The people were absolutely marvellous. And, of course, their country is way, way bigger than ours. But, yeah, Mr. Fils, he taught French. So I hope you're all taking notes on this. It's very important world news. And he was a very jolly man. And he taught us, he also taught us economics. And the only lesson I really remember was about a thing in economics called marginal utility. Yes, stay awake at the back there. Yeah, I was like that too. What? And he illustrated it brilliantly. He used a product which, as 17-year-old boys, we were all very interested in using and were using a lot back then. And it's called beer. You may have heard of it, beer. And he talked about the marginal utility you get from drinking beer. So it's to do with like a satisfaction rating. This is not going to be of any use after I've said this, by the way, but I'm just saying it. And so if you want a beer, imagine you're 17 and you wanted a beer. I've just imagined it then. I can remember those days. I don't drink the stuff much these days, but back then you just did. And if you were to give it a rating out of 10, 10 being unbelievable, right? Like a pint of Timmy Taylor's hand pulled. If you were to, you might say that the first one was an 8. He said, we'd give it an 8 because you really wanted that beer and it's pretty good, right? Now, the second one, and we all heartily agreed on this because we wanted to show that we were good beer drinkers. He said, you'd probably give that a 9. You might even give that a 9. Often the second one was better than the first. The marginal utility on the second one was great. But then began the great, rapid, steep decline in marginal utility. The third one would drop alarmingly, probably down to 6. The fourth one, by which time, of course, I'm much the worse for wear. So, of course, it's just an academic discussion, really. The fourth one, you would get to about 4. The fifth one, you're down to 2. The sixth one, you're down to 0.5. And on and on and on. Of course, we were trying to add up, well, what happens to these people that are able to drink 25 pints? I was never one of those people, thankfully, which I thought was pretty good. But that's marginal utility for you. Okay, the more you have of a thing, the less fun, value, satisfaction you get out of it. A bit like politics, really, and politicians. The more we have of them, the less interested we are in what they're saying and what they're doing, which is, of course, not a lot, is it? So there you go. That was the economics class that I remember more than any other. But we did discuss John Maynard Keynes, who was actually... Yes, he was a compromised individual in that he was a willy woofter. I'm using nice language. Right. So he was a compromised individual, but he also did some really interesting work. And they had a thing, you may have heard of this, called the Bretton Woods meeting towards the end of the war. Was it 1946? In Bretton Woods in upstate New York, is that? Any American people can correct me, but I think it is. And... Keynes was sent as the representative of the incumbent system. Hello, I'm the British pound. And a guy called Harry Dexter White turned up on behalf of the Federal Reserve. Keynes had come out with this idea called a bancor, an international currency unit, to settle the economic differences, as it were, the exchange and balances between nations, B-A-N-C-O-R. Really rather a brilliant device for the time. It was, of course, thoroughly trashed and rejected by Harry Dexter White, who said, no, we're not going to do that. And they just moved everything over to the US dollar. And said, this is now the world's currency, and no one really was in a position to argue against that because of the complete obliteration of Europe and the ruination of its industrial base. And Britain, of course, wasn't doing too good. In fact, that's a tremendous understatement. We were completely knackered by that totally avoidable, idiotic conflict. And so he got his way, did Dexter White, and Wall Street was very happy, and that's the situation that we've been living in up until still just barely now. So they've been looking to replace the US dollar with the digital bit. It's not to be trusted, in my view. Going back to that thing I was talking about, because I've just realized I've come away from the point about this court case and these exchange makers with Bitcoin back in 2015 or whenever it was. The judge could have, at that point, shut them down. And if he'd shut them down and said, I'm not allowing this because it's a threat to the US dollar, which you would think he would say, right, given that he's working for the team. No, he didn't say that. He let it go. And at that point, when I read about that decision, I knew, I'm going to say that I knew this, of course, in retrospect, it might turn out that I was in error, but my decision was, this is a complete fit-up job, because there had been other currencies, sort of online digital currencies that had flourished round about the turn of the century, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, so we're talking 20 years ago now. Doesn't seem like 20 years ago. This century seems like just one big long year. I've still not really got used to it beginning with 20 myself. Don't know how you're fitted up with that. But there was a currency called e-gold. Maybe you remember it. E-gold. And that was to digitalize stocks of gold. And it was very effective. It was very effective. It became a currency that was used by a lot of network marketing and affiliate programs, that kind of thing at the time. This is before Amazon had really kicked in with its big affiliate program. We're talking 2000, 2001. So, and then there was a thing called Seagold, which was pretty much the same. And there was a couple of others. They did the digital silver. And Eagold was run, I think, by two brothers, two American brothers, out in Barbados or somewhere lovely like that. Not Barnsley or Tadcaster or Click Huddersfax or anywhere rough like that. No, it was in Barbados, so they looked the part. And it all panned out really rather well for them until their offices got raided by the thugs and they were completely shut down and obliterated for... Now, what did they accuse them of? Oh, yeah, they were saying something like, you know, that the money is being used to fuel pornography or something like that. You can get the drift, whatever it is. So they've got the power in the press and they've got the power of the courts, which is the most important thing. So that one was shut down. But Bitcoin? Bitcoin was not shut down. So I think that's the conclusion I've come to. You might come to a different one. This is not to invalidate the idea of digital currencies. They're here. And I suppose it's as much a sort of affront to what we think is money as paper money was to people who actually valued gold and precious metals. And gold and precious metals are very intriguing. In fact, I've done so many crazy things with money. After my fandango with the bank, circa 2000, 2001, it all got cleared up by about 2002. And I've mentioned this before, I spent quite a bit of time really researching a lot of the sort of hardcore old money stuff and looking at the Austrian School of Economics, that's the von Mises Institute, and gold. They are champions of precious metals, and the arguments made by people that champion precious metals are very seductive in many ways, and I was kind of attracted to that, so much so that I was contacting gold dealers trying to find out how many sovereigns there were in the world. Now, if you don't know what a British sovereign is, there's a lot of them. I can't remember what the number is now, but I was going through some charts and everything. Hundreds of thousands of these things exist. And, of course, there's just under a quarter of an ounce of gold in them. And I was thinking, I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could mobilize that gold? Instead of it staying in people's sock drawers or whatever they keep it, why couldn't we start to move it around? You see how naive I was, but it was so exciting at the time. And there's a mint, it's still there to this day, called the Sunshine Mint in Idaho. And I believe now that George Soros... You might have heard of him. I think Soros is possibly a major shareholder in it or something like that. Maybe I've got my facts wrong, but he's involved in something up there, and I'm thinking it's that. But we contacted the I was working with a couple of guys, some guys in the States. They were out in Connecticut doing some amazing stuff, actually. Of course, all the good stuff gets shut down. So I've banged into a lot of very creative financial people whose goal was to try and help us, the little guy, you know, get some strength in this game. It's very difficult, as you can see. But we contacted that mint, and we started minting 1 ounce gold coins, and they were fantastic. It was very exciting. And at one time, about 2005, I had 6 of them, 6 ounces of gold. Now, we were a little bit dense when it came to actually making these things. If you've had if you've ever held a Krugerrand in your hand, a Krugerrand in your hand is worth 2 in the bush or something like that. If you've ever had a Krugerrand, you'll know that it's not as shiny as you would think, and that's because there's about 2 or 3% copper in there. This always used to put me right off and go, I don't want any copper, but there's a very good reason for it. What it does is it creates a kind of alloy around the gold. And you can still get the gold out of it, you know, if you take it to a proper place and you want the actual gold in there. But it makes it very durable, which means people can put them in their pockets. I know your pockets have often been full of Krugerrands. Mine haven't. And from South Africa, of course. And we failed to do that. We failed to think that we needed to do that. So what happened was that flecks of gold would come off the corner where the edge was milled. And we didn't actually put one of those little bevels on the side either. Talk about not knowing what you're doing, but boy, were they shiny. And I'd just moved to this the place where we are now, and I'd bumped into a guy here who was I just kept on bumping into people, as you do. And he was rather taken with this stash that I had. And we were in the pub one day, and he knew everybody there. He said, can I just take these 6 ounces of gold off you and go around the pub and show them to my friends? And I went, yeah. I mean, I looked at him. He couldn't run that quick, and I knew where he lived, but that wouldn't have helped me anyway. You know what it's like when people get their hands on things. So, but it was very interesting because I'd never really handled gold before, and I could see him. He was going up to these people, and he was saying, look, here's the gold, and then if you've ever had 6 ounces drop into your hand, boy, it's heavy. You can just feel it. And there's a sort of connection, a visceral connection, that this really is valuable. Of course, it is, actually, for all sorts of reasons. It's an amazing substance, is gold. It's the only thing that that doesn't rot in the Earth's atmosphere. You can destroy it using a certain type of acid, but you have to, you know, really work at it. Their faces were... I asked him afterwards, I said, what did they say? He said, they were all a bit thrilled. And it wasn't out of greed. It was just that nobody handles gold, do they, anymore? And so there's this whole subculture of gold dealers and stuff like that. And I guess maybe they're going to disappear too. But in terms of, you know, it'd be great to go and buy your car with a few ounces of gold, wouldn't it? You know, I don't know what an ounce is these days. 2,000 quid, is it? Something like that. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Sunshine Mint in Idaho, they're still going strong, probably doing a lot of silver stuff as well. But that was part of another sort of a currency idea to try and furnish us directly with a currency that you own. And of course, one of the things about holding gold is that it's in your hand, and you actually do own it. And if you look into the whole of the history of gold, well, not the whole of it, but some of it, you come across all sorts of odd little stories. I think they're still going. There's a gold dealer in England up in and around Liverpool, and they were set up, I think, in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And the guy there that ran it was called taxfreegold.co.uk. It's probably still there, I think, Taxfree Gold. And you could buy any sort of coin from him. But he was very helpful to me. I was trying to get the history of gold and stuff like that. And he said, because then they were looking at these, what are these things? Gold exchange funds. They came up with some new instrument, a kind of gold-backed instrument that, of course, the banks would hold safely for you on your behalf. And he said that he wouldn't trust them with a barge pole. He said, the only stuff you've got is the stuff that's in your hand. And it's full of this kind of skullduggery. So this is 2002, 2003, and the skullduggery I'm referring to there is Johnson Matthey. Now, you may recall that Johnson Matthey were lying about the amount of gold that they held, which is, what a surprise. I mean, who would ever think that bankers would not tell the truth about what their true asset base is? I don't know. What is the world coming to? A ruin, it seems to me. And then there was a case, I think about 10 years or so ago, I don't know if it was Johnson Matthey, maybe another one of the big gold dealers, they were told, they got a tip off that some of the gold that they had in their vaults was probably not gold. And they were sawing through these bars to discover that they were gold-covered tungsten. Oh, you, the criminal mind, eh? I mean, bankers ought to know about it. So that was kicking off all around then, looking at the gold stuff. I think the internet at the time, being a kind of really a wonderful wild west of information, it really was, actually. And it still is, I guess, if you stick your nose into the right places. There were just so many ideas and pieces of information floating around. If you lived in England at the time, if you were alive back then and paying attention to things, you may recall a dreadful individual who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time called Gordon Brown. Do you remember him? I'm sorry to remind you about him. It's not a nice thought, is it? But there you go. There was Gordon Brown, this man with all these strange sort of facial tics and odd verbal delivery and trying to tell us he was going to make Britain great again and all this other nonsense. But I always thought that was going to be a bit difficult for him because he ended up selling off huge chunks of our gold way below the market price. Or at least that's the story we were told. I suspect he did do that. But winding back to that little clip from Liz Truss a bit earlier here in the show, this would indicate, I think, to anybody with a kind of probing mind that he was under instructions to do just that and to dump the government's gold, which is really our gold, you know, yours, apparently. So you're told, that, but you never get to go and see it, and you've just got to trust us. Trust me, I'm a banker. So, the gold thing is still... Okay, got a music request in here, which is good. Actually, it's very it's very apt. I better go find it and try and talk at the same time. And anybody that knows me knows that I'm not very good at that sort of thing. This is called multitasking. I did it once. Gold. Absolutely. Why can't we all just start spending gold again? And on that note, let's see if I can find this musical note. I can. All right, so here we go. This is a request in. It's top of the hour. You listen to Paul English Live here on WBN 324, the Billy No Mates edition of the show. I'll play it and then I'll tell you who made the request. Okay, we'll do that. You'll all know this one. And this taps into, lots of things.
Gold finger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch, such a cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin. You feel for a golden girl knows when he it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. You feel for a golden kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. He loves only gold. Only gold. He loves gold. He loves only gold. Only gold. He loves
Attention all listeners, are you seeking uninterrupted access to WBN 324 Talk Radio despite incoming censorship hurdles? Well, it's a breeze. Just grab and download Opera Browser, then type in WBN324.zil and stay tuned for unfiltered discussions around the clock. That's WBN324.zil.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on the World Broadcasting Network are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of its owners, partners and other hosts or this network. Thank you for listening to WBN 324 Talk Radio.
And welcome back to the show. Just gone 9 o'clock here. We're in the second hour. And shout out there to Warren. Very apt choice. No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. That line, fantastic. And I would like to also bring you some positive news, although it might not turn out that way. But I've been joined by our guest for tonight, Thomas Anderson, who I understand used to play the role of Goldfinger in amateur theatre productions in Germany. And Thomas, welcome to the show. How are you?
Paul, first of all, a big apologize. I know this is life and shit happens, you know. German highways are not as good as they used to be. So I was on the highway.
No.
Lots of construction sites. I didn't expect them. And they were so long and so huge. And there were so many cars on the highway. I simply couldn't move anything forward.
So well, this is just no good. I'm sorry. We've booked another guest now, Thomas. Okay. I was saying, I said,
have a nice evening.
I just said, this is not right. This is not Teutonic efficiency. What's going on? Absolutely amazing. So I didn't want to get all dramatic about it in the show, but I thought, oh, something must have happened to him or something. But he did. You met Roadworks. How thrilling for you. Fantastic. Wonderful.
How thrilling. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, look, welcome to the show. Fantastic. Welcome to the show. I'll just do the little we're here on WBN 324. We're here every Thursday. I've just been joined by the on-time Thomas Anderson. Thomas, welcome to the show for part two. There's an after show as well, Thomas, so if you wanted to talk, you could or whatever. I don't know, because I really want to hear more about your traffic exploits. I think they're really good. It's very, very interesting over here that you have to suffer that stuff as well. And it's actually not been too bad, because it gave me an hour to monologue, which I don't do too much. And, of course, I've got to keep doing that, because the idea is to talk and talk and talk and talk. So, anyway, welcome to the show. I'm most of the people here will never have heard of you or not know of you. I sort of know of you, unfortunately, don't I? We kind of go back a few years. But what would be a good place to start, I think, is for you to do the standard thing, because it really works, is to give a bit of your backstory, who you are, why you write the books that you write, your fields of interest, i.e. why I'm talking to you tonight. What is the backstory that's brought you into the show here this evening?
I have no idea why you're talking to me. First of all, I'm just a normal German guy. I was educated by German school system, which used to be very good, which is now extremely bad. I grew up in a very normal family. My father educated me and taught me things that might be put in a little bit more right angle than a normal angle. So I was more conservative. And at some point of time later, after I visited university, I got to know an older man on a private party. And I talked to him in a very nice way. He was around his, let's say, middle 70s. And of course, as you can imagine, when you're talking to older people, you're talking very, very fast about topics like Second World War and time after the war, etc.
Yeah.
And it was a really nice discussion with him. And around 2 or 3 weeks after this party, I received a letter from him, which was a very nice letter. And I liked him, so I wrote back. We exchanged some letters, and at some point of time, let's say fourth or fifth letter from him, there was something in his letter which I regarded as highly political incorrect.
I like him already. I didn't even meet him.
I liked it very much, so I answered him and discussed this matter, and it got even worse. So the next letter was filled up with things I couldn't accept with my normal education, and in me arose this feeling that on the one side he could be one of those my parents and my teachers always warned me about, to not touch, to not go with them, to not talk to them. On the other side, I regarded him as highly well-educated man, and if he was right, I asked myself, or I told myself, then everything what I learned in school was bullshit. So I took out simply one of his arguments there in his letter and checked it, and I found out he was right. I took the next one, and I found out he was right in everything. Although everything what he wrote contradicted everything what we learned in school. And from this first exchange of some, let's say, alternative facts or alternative views, arose a friendship over the years. And he filled me, he fed me with lots of books, information, background knowledge which he had collected over the years. And that was in the year of 2000.
Right.
So I started rather late to open my eyes, but I had the feeling. I met him then once in a city where we had an afternoon sitting on a nice park bench near a lakeside, and on that day he opened my eyes really very wide. And I went back by train, and I sat in the train. I remember that very well, and said to myself, "Well, if this is really everything true, then my view of the world, of the way we are living, of the society we are living, is completely damaged. Is worth nothing, and I have to rebuild everything." And that was for me the starting point to really research. That was a time where I read 2-3 books a week, and after several months, I had a first, let's say, wide overview about what he was telling me, and then I started to scan some of these books, because most of these books I found were forbidden in Germany. You couldn't get it on the market. You couldn't even get it in archives. And there was only one archive in Berlin which had those books, mm-hmm. although they were forbidden. And I went there, used the wrong name, took with me my laptop and my scanner, and secretly behind the shelf there, sitting in the last corner of that archive, I scanned book after book after book after book. And that is the reason why many of those books are now available on the net, because
you did it. It's you. Got you. We found one.
We found him. Finally,
there he is. Yeah, fantastic.
Yes. Yeah, so, and that started a period of around, let's say, 10 years of research like this, with reading books and books and books and books, and you can imagine when you're reading those books, and you only do this reading and nothing else, you can't think about anything else. You are talking about this, you are dreaming about this, you are thinking about this, and there's not any place for anything else in your life. And the reason
I know
why
that one. I know that one.
The reason why I then started to write my first book was simply the attempt, the hope that by writing a book, I could somehow write these things out of my mind, so that I perhaps may have a chance to think about something different. So I wrote this first book. I put it on the net for free. I don't know how many people downloaded this stuff. I have no idea. And then after some years, I had the wish to do this more professionally. I took this book and visited some publishing companies in Germany, most of them in the area of alternative information, of let's call them politically correct right-wing publishers, and all of them had great fear. They told me, "Hey, Tom, you are right. I know, but I want to have a publishing company tomorrow, so I will not publish your book." And the only one who was, let's say, who had the balls to publish this was Jan van Helsing. This is in Germany a very famous publisher.
Yes.
In the area of those of this kind of books, he wanted this book. He's a good friend of mine, and we published it. And after publishing this book, it was a huge amount of work to get this book on a professional level regarding formatting and pictures and sources, everything.
And they're hard work, aren't they? There's a lot of
hard
detail.
Work, really.
They're very
it,
hard
it took
work,
me
yeah.
many months, yeah.
Yeah.
And after finishing this work and having published this book, I really had the feeling, wow, my mind is free of these things. I finally have a chance to live a normal life. That's great. That's really fine. And
yeah.
Of course, devil is in the detail. 3 weeks later, I got a call from a Chinese woman with whom I was in contact for several years already. I think you might know her or her name, Nancy.
I might.
But I don't
do.
Know if you recall her name. It was of a friend of our common friend.
All right, okay. Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Yes, I know who you're referring to, I think. Yep.
And she gave me a link to the internet to some videos of some American whistleblowers about secret space programs, and I found that quite interesting. I watched some of these videos, and it really got me. I spent around, let's say, I don't know, 500 hours watching videos, video after video after video, and I couldn't resist. I had to do my second book because what I wrote in the first book is already a very good summary of the history leading to the situation of today. But the situation of today, what is really happening now in the background, was not covered. And the second book puts it all together in one complete package. So I think the best way to describe these first these two books is when you're interested in alternative and other news than on the mainstream, and when you want to dive really deep into this, but you don't have the time because you have a family, you have a job, and you have a household. Dog, whatever, hobbies, then you cannot spend 500 hours watching videos. So you need a kind of summary. And my books are this summary. This is why I wrote them. Both books are full of sources. So if anybody has the wish to dive even more deep, well, you're welcome. There are 40 pages of sources with different other books. And every single book of these sources has a certain main topic in which this book dives very deep into, which I can't do in my books because there's simply a limit. 400 pages is already a bigger book, but you cannot do 2,000 pages in one book.
Yeah. The culture of the... in. So this is in Germany, yes? About 25 years ago.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in the... So you talked about these publishers, and I can understand exactly why they responded the way they did. Yeah, obviously they would like to have a publishing business the next day. But has there been a kind of... Because most of us here are, of course, completely unaware of what's actually happening on the ground with German literature, because guess what? We can't read German. Is there kind of a lot of books in this field now? Were you one of the first ones at the time? Or is it still a sort of relatively thin area because of the problems with publishing? What's the sort of state now?
I cannot tell exactly. There are several authors writing books on a regular basis, well-known names, and there's a bigger company called the Kopp Verlag, a publishing company for alternative books, like in topics of health issues and
yep.
Preppers and you name it. So there are books on the market. The real hard stuff is not covered, simply because it's forbidden. On a regular basis, there are books in Germany. Basically, there are scenarios like there's an author who publishes a book which is not wanted on the market. The best thing that could happen to him is that somebody somehow manages to buy all his books on the very first day. So his book simply disappears by buying it out. That's the best thing. It happened.
Right.
Rarely.
Yes, I can imagine.
The more normal thing is it's simply forbidden. It's the police will visit the publishing company, take all the books with them, and that's it.
Yeah, there's nothing new with that. I mean, that sort of excessive governmental editorial control of what the populace is allowed access to is not a new event, but it's interesting to hear that it's obviously still a strong part of the control system over there where you are. This gentleman who taught you so much, and when you were talking about that, I thought, my kind of path is pretty similar. I bumped into someone who taught me a lot of things that sort of bent my head out of shape at the time. The gentleman that taught you, has he shuffled off this mortal coil? I'm assuming he probably has by now.
Yes, he died 4 years ago.
All right, okay. And was the information that he was bringing to you, was it to do, I'm just going to guess here, maybe it was to do with the true history of your country over the first half of the 20th century, that kind of stuff?
Yes, that is the most, that was the most intriguing part for him, because he was a young boy experiencing Hitler time and the war time and the time after the war. So he tried to correct this picture in my head at first. The next bigger topic was bringing this in a bigger framework. Why did this war happen? By whom was this war provoked? Mm-hmm. Who had the advantages of this war and of the First World War II. So that was a second part. The third part was more of a kind of health issue. He came from, let's say, a job in the health branch. He did his job very good, and that was his problem, because of his very good work, the sugar industry lost around 1 billion in the first year, and that was for him the end of his normal life.
So he was actually helping. He did something really silly. He actually helped people.
Really silly.
Yeah.
He took his job very seriously. He did it very good, and then that was the beginning of all his problems.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's such a humongously huge and awful part of history, that period in European history. And I would imagine, I guess, from your point of view, because obviously when we were young here, we were exposed, and we're still exposed to it to the day, to sort of a complete battering ram of propaganda, non-stop. Even today, I mean, not that I look at it every day, but there are programs on here on some of the so-called history channels. There's one called The Buildings That Fought Hitler.
In Germany, we have a series called Bad Buildings.
Right.
And it's referring to everything what the so-called Nazis built there at the time, and in Nuremberg, in Munich, in Berlin, wherever.
They're bad. Are they bad buildings? Is that what they're called?
Bad buildings, yeah.
Bad. Very naughty buildings. It's the buildings that did it to us. It's asinine. I mean, you don't even know where to start. Of course, you see the presenters, and they're completely into it. They're sort of having histrionics when they're going through all these things. And one waits for the calm voice, but it never comes. But it's obviously came to you in the form of this guy, this chap that brought this information. His story must have been quite a thing. I mean, did he have colleagues from that period who had taken the same path of inquiry as he had? Or was it that because he'd moved into the medical area and looking at health, that kind of amplified his knowledge base, and he saw things in an even bigger light than he had done just simply from living through that period? Were there other people around him, or was he a bit of a lone operator?
I can only guess. I guess he raised in a normal family, in a normal way, and he didn't really care about what was happening in history. He started his job, his career as a medical professional, and at some point of time he recognized that something went really bad for the public health. And
yep.
Then he started his work, then he got his problems, and I guess this, he told me once, when those problems began, suddenly whistleblowers came to him and offered him archives, loads of boxes with several documents showing that, whatever, this politician got so much for that, and that politician got a house or a farm in Canada for doing this kind of thing. Everything. And that was the point where he started to put this all together in a wider perspective, in a bigger framework.
Yes. I guess it's a path that many people listening here will recognize, certainly even if it's not for their own life, they'll know it from reading the lives of others that have gone down a similar sort of path, you know, at the path of inquiry and being outside of the herd, and then running counter to the general view and of the populace, which is really what you're all about, you naughty person. And I guess it's what I'm about, and it's certainly what many of the listeners are about, is to actually keep tunneling into these forbidden areas of knowledge to find out. Of course, when you go into them, you find out why they were forbidden, because they reveal so much of the true state of affairs that we're having to cope with. And, of course, more dangerously, the individuals responsible for doing it, which is why I guess he had to be very careful, as I understand your caution around certain things as well. In terms of free speech now in Germany, have you got any? Do you have any left? I wondered if you might have some, because if you got some, you could send some our way, because they're using all ours up. So
I can answer that question very, very fast. No. We don't have
it. You can say nine if you want to. I don't mind. Somebody actually wrote in the thing. I shouldn't tell you this because it's going to make your head swell, but we better do it, because they said we're talking about German people. He said, German people, this is from Eric. Thanks, Eric. German people, he says, he's talking about you, of course, speak fantastic English. Well, they don't all do that, Eric. Of course, some of them are hooligans, but Thomas is not. It says, Thomas speaks English better than most English people do. So there you go. You've always got a job at the BBC, Thomas, if things go bad for you over in Germany, I'm sure.
But I guess the reason for this is because I like the musical My Fair Lady so much, and because I could sing it all with them. And one of the best songs in this musical is "Why Can't the English Learn to Speak?"
It's a good it's a good lyric. Why can't they? It all depends where you go in England. I mean, you can go to certain parts, you won't understand a word they say. And that I include myself. There's so many. I mean, do you have a lot of different dialects and different sounding German people in Germany?
Oh, yes, of course, of course. Yeah. Many, many different. Yeah. Going from east to west, from south to north, let's say 10 minimum.
Yeah.
Easy.
So are there parts of Germany where you could go and you wouldn't understand what they were saying? The accent's so strong. Is there anything where it's difficult?
Well, when you're talking to very old people, you might end up in Ostfriesland, in the far western northern part of Germany, mm-hmm. where the old people speak a language which I really don't understand. I can't. You can get the same when you go to Switzerland or to Austria, to some very remote countryside areas, talking to the farmers there. There you will experience the same, I guess.
Yeah. There's a region over here in England called Tyneside where there are people called Geordies. And I'm from the north of England, so I ought to have really been able to understand them. They're not much further north than me. They probably about 80, 90 miles. And I loved them. I used to spend a lot of time up there on New Year's Eves in the late 70s, early 80s. A lot of fun up there. But their accent is almost impenetrable at times, particularly after several beers. It's absolutely completely, I have no idea what they're saying at all. But they're very, very buoyant sort of people. So I'm glad to know that you have that same sort of thing as well. England's just full of dialects, or wars. I suppose we don't all speak like the BBC, although of course we all want to. No, we don't really. Listen, we're half an hour in. This is a good opening shot. I think we should play one of the songs that I asked you to send
in. Oh, yeah.
Him.
Nice.
Yeah, let's do that. So I'm just going to pick the shorter of the two
one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to do that. So I'm here with Thomas Anderson, and we're discussing his books and his work and the background to all of that. And we're going to raise the cultural tempo a little bit here. Here we go. Oh, we're not. Look at that. You know what happens? I load these things up, and then if I leave them for a bit, they don't want to play. This happens to me a lot. It's very embarrassing, actually. You can feel my embarrassment at your end. I hope you can, Thomas. It's terrible. Let me just find this thing again. Where's it gone now? Dum 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 dum. Uh-huh. Yes. This is, of course, remixed, as they all are, at 4:32, courtesy of our in-house mixing man. The B mix. Here we go. Yes.
Sounds like some sound of techno.
Yeah, let's play this. This is the longer of the two. This is what we're going to do.
Okay.
Thank you.
How marvelous was that? Thomas, what was it that we were listening to?
So first of all, that was Verdi, the opening of the opera La Traviata. I had lots of stops in the transmission of the music file. I hope you, the listeners, didn't have them. It was very nice listening to it in this new transformed or converted version to 432 hertz. It even brings more temperature, more warmth into this music.
It was beautiful. It's really fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. It's just, this is a little thing that happened quite spontaneously where, you know, given that there's a guest on it, to ask you for a song or a couple of songs or tunes, melodies, pieces, whatever we want to call them, and to get the backstory of it. But that was just delightful. It's fabulous. And I'll send you a copy of the actual file afterwards so you can you can have the 432 hertz naughty version. That's what we call them. It's all part of, you know, wherever we can take advantage of the system, that's what we're here to do. So, fabulous.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Wonderful.
So, you told me up front that you would write a huge, unimaginably long list.
Yes. Now you've got to ask me. Now you say, did I? Go on, ask me. Say, Paul, did you do that?
Paul, did you do that?
No. You got to say no earlier, so I wanted to say no now. I didn't think there would be any reason to, and so far it's being proven right. There is no reason to. I've got certain topics in my head. Next one, farming in Germany.
Okay.
We're obviously, we remain, this is when I was talking about the French earlier in the first part, when somebody was on the motorway. You see what I did there? And how I was trained as a young boy to not really get on with the French, but I actually, there's certain aspects of them that I really do admire. The ability for their farmers to fire silage all over public buildings is very impressive. Do you have anything, any counterpart to that going on with the farmers in Germany? Because I've seen certain things, and there are things happening here as well. So your view of what's happening with regards to what is obviously an attack on farming in all the Western Christian nations. How is it in Germany? What does it look like?
So I start with the official point of view. What I see in the mainstream is several demonstrations, small demonstrations here and there, and some jams on the highway because there are some farmers going in very slow motion over this highway. But nothing really about the background, nothing about why they are doing this, and it is not covered in a bigger way in the mainstream media. What we see on Telegram and Rumble and YouTube, this is very much different. So we see that everywhere in Germany there are farmers going on the street with their tractors. They are blocking streets. They are blocking government buildings, local government buildings, blocking ministries. They are blocking the big central warehouses, the logistic hubs of bigger supermarket companies, market leading companies, which then led to partly empty shelves in the supermarkets.
Mm-hmm.
But that was for me as an end customer, when I went to the supermarket, I saw some empty parts here and there, but it was no big deal because everything was still somehow to get. What troubles me when looking on these farmers' protests, not only in Germany, in France, in Spain, in Italy, in Greece, everywhere, is that we had this kind of so-called independent and free coming from people protests also in Germany in 1989 when we had the shortly after that we had the so-called reunion of the two German states. And you remember very well the Wir sind das Volk, we are the people on the street shouting these words in the hundreds of thousands. And now we know that this was very well orchestrated in the background. there were. You have to organize this kind of thing.
Yes.
Buses have to be rented. The buses must drive from somewhere to these places to bring the people there. The people must somehow be collected and motivated to go there. Many of them have to be paid. The same with the so-called Antifa. Also, they get paid, very well paid. you might want to add. So I think we are looking at the same picture here. I assume that this protest is very well organized from the background for a certain reason, of which the farmers are not aware, and they have no background knowledge and no clue why they're brought there to protest against the EU. They are doing it because they have a reason. The farmers, I guess it's everywhere, it's the same. The farmers work from 5 in the morning up to 10 in the evening, earn, let's say, €2,000, can perhaps pay their bills from that, but nothing else. No holiday, no gold ounces on the side, nothing.
Right.
Of course, they're angry with this kind of situation. And when they want to get, when they want to do some, let's say, biological farming, not using the seeds of Monsanto or any other company, of course they get then some trouble with the local authorities, telling mm-hmm. them, hey, you have to do this, you have to do it this way, and when you don't do it this way, then you get some bad echo from our side.
Yes, it's not dissimilar, I guess, to what's going on here. I've seen a few tractor rallies over here, and I think you're right that you see, the whole thing about getting organized is, you know, historically when you look at it, these organizations always get infiltrated. But what are you supposed to do? I think you still need to probably go ahead and do it and try and spot the infiltrators. But they have great ability to turn things over, because, you know, you're talking about them getting paid. It's a great motivator for people who are generally disinterested in things. And there's nothing new under the sun with this approach. I mean, although
well,
I have...
Perhaps...
Perhaps
we should give our listeners a bigger perspective why this might be a wanted protest, and why somebody in the background, for whatever reason, want to pay for this. When you think of these protests, and when they are becoming worse than they are now, simply logical follow-up would be that we start to get empty shelves in the supermarkets. What I read about the UK is that it already has begun there,
mm-hmm.
that you have supermarkets with empty shelves. So when we have that kind of situation,
who's going to get the blame?
Also, who's going to blame? And then also the normal people will start to ask questions. And of course, when there's no food, the people will start to get angry. And this is a perfect scenario for somebody who might have a so-called solution behind his hand. And my fear, because of everything what I learned and read and know, is that we are facing exactly this kind of situation, that the people who earned billions and billions and billions with forced vaccinations, etc., are now in the situation that they invested and now also go on investing billions in building up some plants for so-called indoor farming of, let's call them, biological plants, vegetables, etc. What I heard from a whistleblower in Germany who posted a video some weeks or months ago is that the plan is to have these huge farming plants built up. They are now nearly finished, so they are nearly in operation. And the vegetables planted and grown in there will have genetically manipulated.
You don't say. Yes.
No, I don't say.
Okay. It's an English phrase. Sorry. It's just an English term. Mm. Oh, really? Well, that's a shock.
So, yeah. So, the simple plan is you grow some vegetables like cucumbers, tomatoes, potatoes, whatever, you name it, with some alternated genome in them, which forces them to grow a certain bacteria within these plants. And it's indoor farming, it's biological farming, yes, okay, and then it comes to the shelves at as a normal food, as a biological food maybe, and you buy these vegetables and you eat them, and what you get is not a normal cucumber, but a cucumber with bacteria X. Mm-hmm. And this bacteria X, you might have heard about it, is the reason for the so-called disease X, mm-hmm. of which Bill Gates and other people are talking that somehow a certain pandemic disease X might come in the future, and they want to be prepared for this. Well, I know that they are very well prepared for it.
Yeah.
And so I guess this is the real background reason for these protests of farmers. I know that the farmers have every right to protest and have every reason, and have also my full admiration for what they're doing, but the real reason why they are organizing their protest there is something completely different.
Yeah. We're being continually, I mean, this is a thing that's worked very effectively, is to be divided over some issue so that we can never get to a point of actually seeing that we've all got the shared interests. I mean, working with the farmers, obviously, it's where those people come from that enforce these authoritative diktats. Why do they exist? I mean, I know that they exist. I was told years ago that the people at the top are not going to be your problem. It's your next door neighbor who puts on a uniform. And because the order set is now programmed into his or her head, they become your enemy because they will enforce things to get paid. That's the way, in very simple terms, they will do this because they still are obviously tightly linked with that because they've got to pay their mortgage. This is understandable. It works. I've mentioned here before, I haven't mentioned it for a few months yet, but there's always plenty of time. I'm always talking about the French Revolution. Update, it's still the same, everybody. I haven't done an update on the French Revolution recently. But if you look into that one, it's not French. And again, it's a case of dividing people that were effectively unified and could have easily achieved a peaceful outcome to a whole thing. But agitators were in there, whipping them up, working very hard and paying the necessary people off to bring them into a state of hysteria, which then exploded. All, you know, it was touch and go whether they brought it off, but they did bring it off. And of course, France was the worst for it, in my view, quite clearly, I think, when you look at this stuff. So in terms of look, the food situation, of course, is a major threat. And we are aware, of course, of the Holodomor in the Ukraine in the 1930s. So this is not a new tactic. And I think even Churchill employed it, didn't he, in parts of India to sort of starve a lot of Indians, you know, big, tough guy that he was. So,
Not to forget the 12 million Germans who died of starvation after the Second World War.
Absolutely.
In the so-called Rheinwiesenlager in mm-hmm. Cologne. 12 million.
Yes.
Starved.
Well, as we've discussed before, I mean, and what's not known by most people is that more Germans died immediately after the war than during it, which yeah. which reveals exactly what the plan was. And, of course, all these sentences that they come out with about other groups being the target for extermination turn out to be the complete opposite. It's not the case at all. Where do you think, I mean, in terms of taking actions, like somebody sent me a farmer to contact... I'd like to talk to more than one. I don't know what it's like when you get... What's a collective of farmers, I suppose? I'd like to get some farmers on, a gaggle of farmers or a herd of them or whatever, but I would, to see what their ideas are about trying to form some kind of supportive relationship with the consumer. Because people, when the food dries up, and of course, you see, the thing is that there's no reason for it to dry up, but the psychological message that they're putting out is that it might... And that's having the necessary effect of inducing the fear, causing people to become slightly dysfunctional in the way that they think and do things. I've said this before. It's not as if the actual event has to take place. The mere fact that they say it's going to and propagate it through people's heads achieves a huge part of the desired result in terms of making people slightly defenseless against things. So it's, I mean, we've got a champion farmer over here on TV, Jeremy Clarkson. He's not really a champion farmer. He used to run, he's known as a sort of forthright guy who used to do this great show about cars. Top Gear, it was called, and it just developed into a kind of witty, spontaneous group ensemble. But he's also a farmer. He's been doing a series that's been on Amazon, and I even had my suspicions about that. I don't really have my suspicions about him, but in the grand scheme of things, the idea that they're putting farming across is almost like to get people looking at it more and more and more, which we need to. And then you realize that for most of your life, you've been unconscious about it because the supermarket, right? The supermarket. Everything's always in the supermarket. When you were talking earlier there about empty shelves in Britain, I found it's intermittent, actually. There'll be times when it just appears normal, and then other days I've gone in, and certain things that were nearly always there, they just don't seem to be there. So we still have to find some sort of methodology for dealing with the problem. I mean, does everybody start growing their food at home? It wouldn't hurt. But then they'll probably come up with a law that I think they're looking at. Oh, you can't grow things in your own garden.
That is already the point. Is already the point. Because when you think about this plan, which may be reality, that we're talking about food plans delivering genetically manipulated food and vegetables, which we then will be forced to eat, then the only two solutions I can think of is either you have a local farmer in your village whom you trust, of whom you know that it doesn't use Monsanto seeds, but natural older sorts, and where you can get your food locally, of whom you know that he will deliver, he's able to deliver, and mm-hmm. he wants to deliver. And the other solution is you must do it yourself, at home. And the what we already heard from our famous friend Klaus Schwab is that local farming at home leads to global boiling, so it will be forbidden. This is exactly the plan, because of CO2 footprint, whatever. So the only possible solution will be eliminated by this.
Well, we don't want too much CO2, do we? I mean, it's very, very bad for us, because Klaus says, and he is our friend, of course. He's really thinking about
us.
Of course, he is. He's a lovely man. If he is a man, I don't know what he is, really.
I mean, you never can be sure. I just yesterday, I read that Emmanuel Macron's lovely wife forgot to tell us something.
Right.
I saw a picture which was very similar to the wife of our American friend Barack Hussein Obama, his wife Michelle, sorry, also forgot to tell us something.
What's that? What are you talking about? Mick, call him Mick. Sorry,
Mick. Yes. Mick. Call her.
Yeah. Sorry. Mick, sorry. Yes.
It's everybody at the same. It's Emmanuel Macron's wife. It's Obama's so-called wife. It's Cher. Even Cher. I couldn't believe when I saw the picture. There are so many.
Well, it's part of the, isn't it part of the sort of demoralization attack? The idea is literally to subvert every single area of our lives that we've come to rely upon as possibly having a modicum of truth in them. And suddenly you find out that everything is unfolding and unwinding and falling apart. And the real spell that's being cast is that however they're all held together, I don't know whether it's a combination of money, threats, bribery, corruption, whatever, the whole lot, they all appear to be, you know, calmly saying the same things. Oh, there's too much carbon dioxide. It's not possible. I've seen some of these interactions with these Muppets that say this, to actually get their brain to work properly and understand that we need more carbon dioxide, that it's lovely, it's great, the trees love it, and they give us lots of oxygen. So what are you talking about? So there's nothing. None of the arguments are arguments, really. They're not meant to actually make any sense, because they don't. And this sort of introduction of, what would you call it, Marxist rhetoric, idiotic ideology, has just been ramped up more and more and more this century. It certainly wasn't after 9/11, but the last 5 or 6 years or so, they've just gone absolutely bananas on it. And of course, we tap into these agendas that the UN have got, you know, 21 and 2030. They're on track to sort it all out. And the main problem, or a key aspect of it, is that there are no characters in the media, not that I watch it anymore, who actually stand up to these people and start giving them a verbal tongue lashing and mocking them. They've all been moved out. There's literally no journalists left. I mean, you know, that's not saying
in
too
Germany,
much.
In Germany, we have that sometimes we have the situation that a formerly very well known a speaker of the ZDF, the second German television, or the ARD, the first one, mm-hmm. Leaves his job and enjoys his pension, and then after he quit his job, suddenly he changes his mind completely and then pops up in some independent areas and channels and Telegram, etc., speaking about what the mainstream media does wrong. And what he partly was forced to say about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
There was also, I remember, it was 5 or 6 years ago, there was a weatherman who suddenly spoke about chemtrails live on television. He was fired the very next day.
Wow. Who was that journalist? Was it Udo? Was that his first name? Blonde hair, glasses.
Udo Ulfkotte.
That's
Udo Ulfkotte, yeah.
Now, they did away with him, didn't they? He came out and just said, look, I've been basically an asset of the CIA. I've been lying to you most of my life. I've had enough of it. I remember that. He didn't make 60, did he? I think he was gone sometime in his mid-50s. Of course, keeping these stories alive for us is tricky. We don't have all these resources. When you look at sort of news organizations, they've got thousands of people working in them, basically full on lying non-stop. All of them, of course, thinking that they're telling the truth, which is very bizarre. You know, they're very odd individuals.
Meanwhile, since last, let's say, 40 years, the people in charge all went to the same school education with the same lies, and part of those former pupils became teachers, and those teachers again taught the same lies to more and new pupils. And so we are talking now about, what, 4 or 5 generations who have gone through these schooling systems being fed only with lies. Lies mm-hmm. about everything, about history, economy, science, everything.
Everything.
Wherever you look at, you find lies. And lies on very important details.
Yes.
It's not only history. History is, of course, the best thing what you can look at when you want to target lies easily. But when it's about science, it's not very much different.
It's not really. I mean, science is it's on its way, or wants to be on its way, to becoming the new god for everything. Technology, this is going to solve all our problems, but of course it isn't going to do that. I tend to think of science as a discipline that's very useful when applied to the tools that we need. We're great tool makers, you could say. But my definition of it is science is a skill set that aims to be less wrong tomorrow than it was today, because it's continually adjusting where its focus is. And that's fine. I'm not actually using it as a criticism. I'm just observing it. But some of these people in that field go, we know the absolute truth. And I go, you absolutely do not. Wouldn't you, if you look at the history of science, doesn't that show you that all those previous scientists prior to you, they were all saying it wrong, because you've discovered this new particle, or you've discovered this new force. There's so many different aspects of things that get discovered, and it's very useful that people do that. But it's when they say, well, you know, what's that thing? When you've got a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. I often think that they're like, that science is going to solve everything. No, it's not.
But that's only one side of it, because what you were now telling is the normal evolution of knowledge. Now it's very much visible for nearly everyone that we do not have only the evolution of knowledge, but only also the defamation and the crippling of knowledge by force, by will, by agenda. Mm-hmm. So the so-called scientists who now claim that CO2 is a bad thing. I guess many of them think that they are right. That may be true, yeah. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be named scientists. But some of them know that they are lying. And they are lying because they are told to do so, or they mm-hmm. are paid, or both, to do so. And, yes. and some of them even have the wish because they think there's a higher reason and justification for what they're doing.
Yes.
And there can't be a justification for telling a lie.
No, they can't. They can't. These are the strangest times that I could think would have ever befallen us. They're very odd. They're not quite how any of us, I suppose, expected things to go. And the main thing, or a key aspect, is the compliance of so many people with ridiculous instruction sets. It's to me, it's bizarre. It's also extremely, it's scary, because then it's about the people around you actually sort of getting out of kilter. Thomas, we're coming towards the end of the yeah. formal part of the show.
You might give me the chance to remind you of what we were talking about just before 2 or 3 days about citation. And what you were telling just now reminded me of that.
Yeah.
We were talking about truth and lies, and I told you, who doesn't search the truth will not find it.
Yes. This is true. It's all about an attitude. I think it's definitely about an attitude. I've been talking here. We're coming to the end of our stint on WBN 324. We'll be back again at the same time next week, which will happen to be 8 p.m. in the UK and 4 p.m. US Eastern, because we're still on a time lag. So apologies for not letting everybody know that. My guest tonight has been Thomas Anderson, and he may be hanging around for a post-show. We'll still be talking a little bit on Rumble, but we're coming off the main radio stations now in about 45 seconds. I'll wrap it up in a formal way. Thomas, it's been great that you got here. And of course, because we only got half of you for this part of the show, the invite's open to come on and finish the other half. Maybe you could come for the first hour and another one and then shoot off or something. I don't know. I don't mean that, of course.
I will leave for the motorway then the next part, the second hour.
That's fantastic. Okay, brilliant. So that's I'm here with Thomas. If you want to carry on listening, we're going to be on Rumble for a little while, just a few minutes, and then we'll give you indications of where there's a post-show taking place in another format. Thanks very much, okay. Thomas.
Thank you.